Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you've heard the show before, you know that each week we visit with World War II veterans. The idea is to honor what they did, honor their service and sacrifice that provided the freedom we enjoy in our country today. Also, to preserve their stories for posterity, for future generations to hear and remember and value. And maybe along the way, the rest of us younger folks, can be inspired by what we hear from these living members of what's been called the greatest generation. Our guest today, certainly no exception. He's 93 years old, and he's a bomber pilot turned preacher. You're going to enjoy this story as we visit with John Shearer, who makes his home in Fresno these days. Growing up before World War II, now you're 93, which means when Pearl Harbor happened, you had just turned 25 years old, so you're a little older than some of the gentlemen that I've interviewed before. Tell me what you were doing at the time Pearl Harbor happened, and maybe what you remember. If you're a preacher, I imagine you were in church that Sunday morning, December 7th, 1941. Not that you were a preacher yet.
No, I was thinking that I was in school, and consequently, when we heard it, everybody ran to the room to listen to the radio. And that's about all I can remember about the Pearl Harbor day, yeah.
But you decided that you were going to serve, and at your age, like I said, a lot of the younger guys are the ones that I interview, but you were 25 at the time this happened, and by the time that you got into the Army Air Corps, I guess you're probably a little older than that.
Well, I don't know whether you would want to know this or even the public would want to know it, but I had started to study for the ministry way back when.
Mm-hmm.
I'd gone to school in Chicago, and then I'd gone to school in Boston.
Uh-huh.
And consequently, everybody was going into the service, and I was not about to run away from the Lord's will, because I had found what ornery, individual I was about that time. And consequently, I prayed very much about it, and finally the Lord said, go.
So here
I enlisted back there in 42.
So you hadn't been drafted?
No, I was not drafted. I volunteered, enlisted, and
so you felt that God was telling you, instead of ministering to a church body here or there, that your calling was to become a pilot?
Right at that time, yes, sir.
So you enlist in the Army Air Corps, and the next week they said, okay, you can fly. Not quite that easy, is it?
Not quite. I, in fact, for my own information, and I don't know where I wrote it down, but I first of all, I think it was in Nashville, Tennessee, that they, let me put it this way. I enlisted in the fall of 42.
Right.
They didn't call me then until 43.
Uh-huh.
Consequently, after I was called, they put me in sent me to Nashville, Tennessee. I got my pre-flight, indoctrination there.
And was it what you expected it to be, or were there a lot of things that you encountered that you hadn't anticipated?
I don't think of anything that really turned me off.
Now, a lot of guys, when I talk to guys who ended up as pilots in the Army Air Corps during World War II, most guys wanted to fly something quick and maneuverable, a fighter plane. I haven't talked to a lot of guys who got into the Air Corps because they wanted to fly a big, heavy bomber. What was the case in your circumstances?
Well, I had always wanted to fly. There's no getting out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, when I enlisted, I knew that there would be training. So, as I said, that pre-flight, all that I got in Nashville, and then from there, after that, they sent me to Tuscaloosa, Alabama,
mm-hmm.
where I started out in my primary training.
Right.
We had and at my age and after all these years, so many times I forget. Our training was in a biplane.
All right.
And I enjoyed that very much. And I even would do my loops and go into...
You wouldn't be doing that in a B-17.
No.
That much we know. So you had the smaller planes to train in then.
Right.
At what point did you realize...
Excuse me.
Oh, that's all right.
Okay.
At what point did you realize that you were going to be flying bombers? That was a choice that they made for you, I'm assuming.
Well, from there, I went on to basic training, and that was in a BT-13.
Uh-huh.
And... one of the things I would never do, I would never put it into a spin because we'd known that they were the hardest thing ever to get them out of a spin. So I
and
never.
And people had learned that the hard way.
Yeah. So I did. I wouldn't do it except with a trainer with me. So consequently, I got that and finished that up. That was in Greenwood, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
I moved on then to advanced, where I then got into a two-engine plane, AT-10,
mm-hmm.
and spent my time flying that and enjoyed it very much. One thing I remember, we took a cross-country one day, and we always had two pilots.
You see? Right.
The fellow who was acting as my co-pilot, we landed. And before I told him to, he released the tail gun, the tail wheel, and we were a big spin. And I had to tell what had happened, and we're okay.
Yeah, to debrief him on why that took
yeah.
place, huh? Well, it's funny how you learn what not to do in an airplane.
Right.
Sometimes it only takes you once.
Well, we finished up there.
Mm-hmm.
And after I got, and that's where it was Stuttgart, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
I got my wings then, and I got my commission there. And was not there very long until they sent us and said, you're going to go into a B-17 bomber.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I wanted really to be in a biplane and twin-engine plane, but,
mm-hmm.
Well, that's where they sent us. That's what we did, obeyed what they said. So they sent me to Alexandria, Louisiana.
Well, they figured, you want two engines, we'll do you one better. We'll give you four.
So consequently, when I went to... Alexandria, Louisiana, I found, first of all, I'm going to be a co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So from that time on until, well, let me take you from here. After we were there I'm going to guess 2 or 3 months,
mm-hmm.
my first pilot was a man by the name of Ed Daniel, a boy from Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And... We really got together, no problem whatsoever. So after we had finished there, they sent us up to Grand Isle, Nebraska to get a B-17. We waited there, checked out the airplane, and so consequently, after we were there for a while, then they said, okay, take the plane, head east, and take it to England. So we went back to New Hampshire. I've forgotten the name of the base we stopped at, but from there up to Goose Bay, Labrador. On our way up there, I got a cold. By the way, am I talking too much?
No. I you're doing great. And you know, I the question that occurred to me though, and maybe our listeners are wondering too, and you talk about the B-17, and just listening as you go from this area to this area, all the different training, different planes. Then you finally end up with a plane that you know you're going to fly in combat, and it's bigger than anything you've flown before. What was your first impression of the B-17? Did you get used to it pretty quickly? Did you like it? Did it seem like a little too much for you? What was that like for you?
Well, I'll say this about it. It was, how will I say it? It was a heavy plane, but I was glad it was it instead of the 24. We were so proud of it. Well, now, I just took you over to Goose Bay, Labrador, but on our way to Goose Bay, Labrador, lo and behold, I had got a cold, terrible cold, and I had to say, Daniel, we got to let level off for a minute until let's get the air back in my ears. So we got on the ground. They sent me this sick call, and they were going to keep me there for a while, and what they were probably going to do was send somebody to take my place, and they'd be on their way. Well, Daniel, my first pilot, was able to talk his way into anything and out of anything. So he persuaded them to wait for me until I get over. So in about, I'm guessing, a week or 10 days, we took off for Iceland. All right, overnight in Iceland, that was quite an experience. We had flown across the south end of Greenland. Mm-hmm. And anyway, stayed all night, enjoyed ourselves, took off and headed south toward Ireland. Most beautiful sight I ever saw was the greenness of Ireland. And so we, lo and behold, something that disagrees with what you said a moment ago.
Yeah.
That airplane was left there to prepare it for war. So consequently, they sent us across the bay over to England, on down to our base in England, Poddington, England.
That's right, and that would be your headquarters there with the 92nd Bomb Group and the 325th Bomb Squadron.
325th.
Right, and I want to ask you, you talked about Daniel persuading them to wait for you. Have you ever thought about how different your experience would have been had you gone over with guys you never knew before as opposed to all these guys you had spent all that time training with?
I sure did, because when we first met and we had a good time together and we flew together in training and all of that, it was ideal.
And it seems to me when you're on a bomber crew and you're on a mission and you'd go on to fly 33 missions, so I think you're going to know where I'm going with this, you need to be able to trust each other to have that rapport and know that this guy is doing what he's supposed to do and you know that you can count on him. And if you're serving with guys you never met before, it's a little harder to trust them, isn't it?
He and I were very close. Mm-hmm. Not only he and I, but the entire crew. You are never putting your life on the line with a group like this, and we were as if we were one.
I've heard that from a lot of people on bomber crews, how much they appreciated that rapport and camaraderie. We need to take a break, but when we come back, we'll get into some of these 33 missions that John Shearer flew with the 8th Air Force, more specifically the 92nd Bomb Group and the 325th Bomb Squadron. We'll talk about the logo that squadron chose. Maybe you'll get a kick out of that. Hometown Heroes continues next. It's News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Wild Blue Yonder, an appropriate way to bring us back to the program. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ. We're talking to U.S. Army Air Corps veteran John Shearer today. He's 93 years old. You wouldn't know it by listening to him, and you especially wouldn't know it if you heard him preach. He was preaching just last weekend. He's been doing that for more than half of his life, and we'll talk more about that before the show's over. For now, let's continue with what he was doing in World War II. He flew 33 missions with the 325th Bomb Squadron of the 92nd Bomb Group, part of the 8th Air Force in Europe. And your squadron, for its logo, this is one of the things that I really enjoy. Every unit in the Army had one logo or another, and a lot of them incorporated popular characters of the day. And for yours, I don't know, maybe you know the story of how it originated, but your logo is a comic book character, Alley-Oop. Tell our listeners who might not be familiar who Alley-Oop was and why you understand he became part of your logo for the 325th Bomb Squadron.
Well, of course, Alley-Oop used to be in the funnies, you know, and every paper, and we always followed it real close and enjoyed it so much. But why they chose it, I do not know.
And Alley-Oop was a caveman who traveled through time, right?
Yes, and we enjoyed always the things of concerning him. It was fun. That's all I can say.
So your logo for your squadron is Alley-Oop with his club in his hand raised, and he's what is he riding on?
A tiger.
So he's flying on a tiger.
Yep.
All right. Hey, you guys weren't with General Chenault and the Flying Tigers in China, but
no.
You had Alley-Oop on flying on a tiger in Europe. 33 missions, and obviously we don't have time to talk about all 33. But I often like to ask veterans about the very first mission because that seems to stand out in someone's mind. And I imagine there was some anticipation on your part and the part of your crew after all that training and all that waiting. Okay, now this is finally it. What do you remember about that first mission and what it felt like?
Well, I'll admit that we were apprehensive as we went on the mission. Now, I better back up.
Okay.
I flew with our first pilot, Daniel. I don't know how many missions, but it wasn't long until he moved up in the squadron. Consequently, they turned around and they checked me out as first pilot.
All right.
I went over as co-pilot.
Right.
Then he checked me out as first pilot, or I should say the general did.
So, and there's a pretty decent difference in responsibility between those two positions, isn't
very
there?
Very much. And I think that we were just as much close together. But another thing I want to bring out here, we were not all the same crew as we went over. Each time, well, maybe I kept with the old crew a bit, but then it was always a different group of men that I would fly with.
And you had to trust them to do what they were asked to do and follow the instructions for the mission. You remember anything about that first mission, or?
Not really. I just remember the apprehension. I remember Daniel, the first pilot, got out of his seat. He wanted to see things, and he got back in the Bombay area and went to look around. And the first thing you knew, the Germans were letting us know they were down there. You should have seen how fast he got back up into the pilot seat. And held up my flak vest to me so that if something did happen, he and I would be protected anyway.
And so, I like the way you put that. The Germans were letting us know down that they were down there as if they were waving to you with flak firing at your airplane.
Yes.
And speaking of flak, you showed me a moment ago a little souvenir that you carry around. You've got it right next to your wings, which you talked about earning in November of 1943. But that's not part of your wings. It's a piece of metal, I'd say, what, about an inch long, half an inch thick? How did you come to be the proud owner of such a unique souvenir?
Well, it's a long story in a way, but should I mention the fact that one of our missions was away over on the east side of the Denmark Peninsula. And we had to go across the North Sea between Norway and Sweden was on the north side. We had to go across the North Sea, over past the Denmark Peninsula, and go way out and around and come back in and drop those bombs right on the corner of the southeast part of the North Sea. And on the way, of course, we got that hit my side and knocked out the plexiglass, missed my neck, probably be a foot or so. But then I told you earlier when I got back home, I dug it out between the skin of the aluminum skin and the cast iron top turret and saved it. But anyway, on that
mission, so you were obviously aware at the time that this flak was coming in. You heard it hit.
Yes. And very much so. In fact, we always heard it when it would click against the plane, sometimes very hard. I remember, I think it was our bombardier a flak came through and hit his leg. He had a wound in his leg from it. Wasn't bad. But we're always hearing some of the flak hit the airplane. Well, on that day, one hit our number three engine, and it on the number three engine, it hit the oil lines.
Cut the oil lines.
Were under pressure.
Uh-huh.
Oil lines were used to feather the props.
Right.
That number three engine, we pushed the button, could not feather it. Consequently, that prop kept windmilling, no oil on the hub of it, started to get red hot. Mm-hmm. We knew it was coming off. The prop was going to come off. Consequently, we went and sent the fellows back to get our parachutes and put them on, put the plane in automatic pilot, because we knew that prop was going to come off in the day or so before the prop had come off and hit the tail, and down into the English Channel went that B-17. So anyway.
So you knew what was at stake and what was possible here.
We were waiting and waiting, and finally, dump, and off went the prop, missed the tail, went into the North Sea. And one of the first things I think I can remember is calling SOS. Consequently, they answered and said what the heading was to the very nearest place on the shore of England.
In other words, you weren't going to be able to fulfill the course that had been set for you. You were going to have to find somewhere else to take this B-17 down.
And all the rest of the squadron after we got hit was naturally gone away ahead of us. And we had been, well, I don't remember what our altitude, but not probably more than 2,000 or 3,000 feet. And finally, we made it right back to the base. And as you said, you had seen in that picture.
Well, let me set that up, and let me ask you, too. It occurs to me, and I talk about your vocation. I introduced you as a bomber pilot turned preacher, and you've been a minister for more than a half century. You'd been to Bible college before this. I'm curious if in those intense moments, if someone of your faith, if it comes over you to pray, to make that a priority, or if in the heat of the moment you don't even have time to have that thought?
No, very, very little. I'm sure I talked to the Lord at various times.
Sure.
And I was just as scared, don't get me wrong, I'm just as scared as the other fellows, except I knew I was where God wanted me to be.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But anyway, one thing I wanted to bring out, as soon as we got on the ground, naturally they let our home base know that we were back because they thought we were gone.
Because your squadron went on ahead and they thought your plane was somewhere in the sea.
Yeah, we were already gone.
And you mentioned pictures of that. Now, you during the war had gotten a video camera from a film camera from your brother. And you were taking pictures, and even some from the nose of the airplane on some of your time in the air. And I've seen some of these pictures, and that image is the one that I can't get out of my mind. When you brought that plane down, what that propeller or that number three engine looked like?
Well, that whole prop,
mm-hmm.
the whole area around it, it had chewed into the cowling of the airplane. And consequently, it looked bad, and of course we had to fly now on, don't forget, two inches on one side, one engine on the other. Had to watch how much you feathered or held back one of the engines. But anyway, what I got to tell you is we got back and they let our home base. The man who had been my first pilot jumped in a plane from our home base, came right over and landed at the coast. And I'll tell you, to show how close we were, he put out his hand to shake my hand, and tears were running down his cheek.
Wow.
Because he thought that we were gone.
He thought you had died, and there you were.
Yep.
And that does really illustrate the bond that the two of you developed.
All of us were the same way. It's all of us the same way. We just the closeness. Even yet today, there are four of us still left. Excuse me. Four of us still left. The radio man, Schmidt from back in Illinois, one of the gunners, Sally Rosso from down in Pueblo, Colorado, and Joe Besty from back in Minnesota.
So he have kept in touch with them over all these years?
In touch with them all over these years. We still do.
That's
I got to call Chet Smith some of these days and let him know how things are going.
Well, maybe he'll get a chance to listen to this program today. We can send him a copy when we're done. John Shearer is our guest today. He flew 33 missions in B-17s during World War II. You've heard a little bit about that. We're going to hear more when we come back. And we'll also hear the idea that he and a couple other pilots had immediately after the war and what that idea has turned into in today's world. I think you'll really be blown away by that twist to this story. Much more to come as we continue with Hometown Heroes next. It's News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A little more than halfway through the program today with John Shearer, 93 years old. He was a B-17 bomber pilot in World War II. And just about ever since the war, he's been preaching in one venue or another. He's been a pastor in different spots throughout California. And today, while he's not the pastor of one specific church, he continues to travel around and preach where needed. So maybe you've heard him in the pulpit once or twice. Maybe you recognize that voice that sounds a lot younger than 93. He must be doing something to stay young. And let's talk about when you were a pretty young man, a good-looking young pilot. And I've seen some of those pictures, some the video that we talked about that your daughter had transferred from the film you took during World War II. Some of it's color, some of it's black and white. We talked about the torn-up engine on your B-17, which you guys did land. You told us how your friend, Pilot Ed Daniel, came and picked you guys up. And since he picked you up, that meant you guys had to get back to work and fly some more missions. And there are a couple other things with regard to your missions that I'd like to ask you about. One, I'm going to have to backtrack because you still have, as a lot of pilots do, the official record of all the missions that you flew, all 33 missions. One of those pretty early on, in fact, it looks like it might be your fifth mission. I was struck by the date on there because it says June 6th, 1944. Of course, everybody who knows World War II knows that was a very significant date, the beginning of Operation Overlord, the invasion of Normandy. That was D-Day. And it appears that you were flying a mission somewhere over France. Do you remember what your duties were that day, what you guys were doing, and maybe when you realized how significant a day that had actually been in the grand scheme of things?
Well, other than the fact that we knew that we were going in and... of course, in the back of my mind, I had in mind those men that were down on the beach making their way up. And I couldn't help but think of it. But I can still remember, we were supposed to have radio silence.
Uh-huh.
But I can still remember somebody on our plane all of a sudden said, "Man, did you ever see so many ships down there?" And of course they were just covering the English Channel, and we went in and dropped our bombs, and it seemed like such a relief, though, after going over the beach, making a circle and coming back to England. It was a very prominent day. There's no getting out of it. We were very, in a way, maybe thankful that we could be a part of starting this war that was going to stop the whole thing.
And I imagine also, you talk about someone looking down and saying, "Have you ever seen so many ships before?" The sky probably looked pretty dense too, maybe like a swarm of locusts with all the airplanes in the sky.
So many airplanes, it doesn't seem possible. May I even divert back to the same idea? We were later on when the bulge came, I can remember we went over, and this was the same idea of what you just said. And when we were coming back, I had never seen so many airplanes coming toward us. Now, had I been there just watching the airplanes come in, there would have been hundreds and hundreds of airplanes coming in. And, of course, the fighters were down. And I later on talked to some of the men that were fighters and how the work that they had to do and how they were had been in the cockpit so long, they became practically stiff and sitting there.
Mm-hmm. Frozen now, in those seats.
Which, of course, for the fighters was different than for us. But at the same time, we could not help but think about all of the other fellows that were coming in. And some of the aircraft, anti-aircraft guns would get right to them and probably lost some of the ships. But we did not. We were very fortunate.
You know, another question that came to my mind, and one of the images that sticks out to me in the video that I watched, the pictures that you took, and this is fairly unique. There are a lot of veterans that had snapshots, you know, had still cameras during the war. Not too many actually had moving pictures with them, certainly not in the cockpits of plane unless they were on an official duty. And it was really neat to see some of the images that you captured. One of the ones that stuck with me, too, as you're taking these pictures out of the nose of the aircraft, was when a couple P-47s came up alongside you to provide escort. And you actually called on the radio, I guess, to tell them to come forward to get a picture of them, right?
This was the day that I said we got hit so bad.
Right.
And I knew those fighters were around. And I had looked down and I had seen them some, maybe 100, 500 feet below us. And then I thought, well, why don't I get with my camera, get some pictures? And so I...
Which I'm thinking, you might die on this thing. You're in a limping airplane. What are you thinking pulling out a camera? How do you get to that point?
Well, anyway, I pushed the button and talked to them and say, would you come on up?
Uh-huh.
I would like to get some pictures. And as you said, I have it on the video that I got some pictures of them flying. It was P-47s, by
yeah.
the way.
Uh-huh.
Ooh, did we love those. And the P-51s. Ah. The only thing was, the fastest thing I think I've ever seen was a P-51 on the tail of an ME-109. Oh, could they go fast.
Good thing the 262 from Germany wasn't flying by. Well, that you would have blinked and missed that, I suppose. But I was curious how often you actually had fighter escort on your missions. I know in that case, they came to your rescue because you were limping in.
Yes, we were all by ourselves. But they were with us always. Fighters were around.
Uh-huh.
But we didn't see them that much. No, we didn't see them that much. But we knew they were always there with us.
Mm-hmm.
And it made us feel thankful for these airplanes.
And I know you were thankful when you finally got to come home from the war. When you got in, I imagine, was it 25 missions the requirement to come back, probably when you started flying, that's where the bar was set?
Well, yes, when it started, and they moved them up to 30 and then on to 35.
They were playing keep away from you.
Was that?
They were playing keep away from you. Every time you got close, they moved it a little further away.
Well, the thing was, we weren't losing as many planes
right.
as they thought. Well, anyway, they prorated mine. So, see, otherwise I would have gone to 35.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, I just flew the 33 missions.
And another thing that you still have here, and I'm holding the news clipping right here. Boy, this is a good-looking lieutenant here with his hat on and everything from the Hope, Michigan newspaper, I suppose. And it says, Hope Flyer home from 33 missions over Germany. So this is when you came home. And it says that First Lieutenant John William Shearer, who also wears the coveted Distinguished Flying Cross, the Air Medal, and 3 Oak Leaf Clusters. You didn't tell me about the DFC. How did you earn that very prestigious medal?
Well,
I know you don't want to brag.
I don't know. Really, I don't.
You think it was just for the number of missions that you flew?
It may be.
Something that your unit had been involved in, perhaps?
It could have been. It may have been. One thing I will say, I don't think any of the men felt, a pat on the back for what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
We were just doing what we ought to be doing. And so none of those things even really pat me in the back.
I can tell that you're a man that values heavily doing what you know you should be doing. And you talked about how you felt it was God's call on your life to go in the military. And I guess at this point, you decided it was time for you to exit the military after you came home from those 33 missions. Another thing, though, I want to ask you about on that video, you talk about seeing the Statue of Liberty when you sail back into New York Harbor. And I've heard a lot of veterans mention that. What was that experience like for you? What was the greater significance of that moment?
I really can't picture it, but I know this. Every one of us, and I especially, noticed when I saw that Statue of Liberty, oh, thank the Lord for that, because we realized it was not only for me, but it was also for any of the other men. But it's made us stand up again and say, thank you, Lord, for America. Thank you for the privilege of serving our country. And the liberties that we have goes way back to the time of the Pilgrims in that time. And what they put into our Constitution and in our bylaws, oh, how we have much to be thankful for. And when I find somebody taking this flag or anything like that, I'll have to admit, my ire really comes up because I said, I put my life on the line for that flag and for our country. Don't disparage what we have done.
And you and a lot of your friends put their lives on the line at the same time. 16 million Americans were serving during World War II, the time that we've been talking about with John Shearer. I want to ask him about what he did once he got home and the idea that he and a couple other World War II pilots had that turned into Missionary Aviation Fellowship. How significant is that organization today? I'm going to tell you, and we'll hear about its origins when we come back. Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch next. You're listening to News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Time is running short on the program, as it often does. I'm sure we won't have time to discuss everything that John Shearer experienced in his time in World War II or what he's done since then. He's been a pastor at several churches throughout California, most recently Dinuba Calvary Baptist, where he retired in 1975. I shouldn't say retired, because he's been an interim pastor, a visiting pastor. You may have heard a sermon or a Sunday school lesson from him from time to time, and I understand you plan on preaching till at least 95, right? That's 2 years from now.
Oh, there's no limit.
No, I don't want to hold you back, for sure. And I'm not calling the shots anyway. We know who is. Speaking of, you get home from the war, and I understand that you and a couple other pilots conspired to come up with this organization, which is today known as Missionary Aviation Fellowship. And before we hear about the beginnings, I want to tell our listeners what this organization is today. Today, Missionary Aviation Fellowship owns 122 aircraft, flying more than 6 million miles a year into 55 countries, serving more than 1,000 Christian and humanitarian organizations. In other words, airplanes are helping the ministry and missionary efforts around the world. And this was an idea that you were in on the ground floor with. Tell me how you got involved and where this all started.
All I can remember is that a number of pilots of World War II, and were interested in Christian work and missionary work. We got together, and I think Jim Truxton was one. I think Charlie Millis. I can't think of all the others. And there was a missionary from New Guinea, and I can't remember his name. But he had already started to get some plane and doing some flying. And so we said, well, why shouldn't there be an organization where we could get together and have these pilots transfer these missionaries from this place to the other? They could go in probably in a half hour what would take 2 or 3 weeks otherwise over the mountains or bad through the jungle. Mm-hmm. So consequently, as time went on, and I even was so interested that after I had finished my schooling, after I got back, I came to the West Coast and got my mechanics rating so that I could qualify to be one of those pilots to transfer missionaries from one place to another.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was the way it, and Betty Green, as you mentioned, also was very active in it.
She was the first. She flew the first official flight for the organization way back in 1946.
Right.
So you were part of the genesis of the idea, and you wanted to be one of the pilots.
Right.
But how did it end up working out?
Well, as it was, I the Lord closed the door for me to go to the mission field. Not saying thing as to how the Lord knew, and consequently, that was not the end of my ministry. It was not to be the end, and so I kept on going into the Christian ministry. But I was so glad to be able to be one of those that helped get this going. And today it is, like you mentioned, it is going and going fast and transporting many of them. And I'm still on their mailing list, even though I'm not one of the active ones in MAF.
You'd probably fly if they let you, though, wouldn't you?
Well, very much so. Very much so.
I had a feeling you would say that. You know, looking back, and it's been 65 years since you were in the service and since you flew your last mission. And in that time, as I said, you've been so involved in the ministry throughout the state of California and all over the place. But when you look back on your time in the war, you think about close calls like that piece of flak that you carry around. You think about the fact that you have 5 children and 15 grandchildren and 7 great-grandchildren who never would be here if that flak was a few inches off and hit your neck instead of the airplane. I have a feeling you have a theory on why that all worked out the way it did. How do you account for that? When you think about those things, what comes to mind?
Well, have to say this, that the Lord was definitely in it. And in a certain respect, you'd say, well, this is a miracle for God to protect me and to bring me back home, because I had no promise. I had no promise that he was going to bring me home. I was just as open to be shot down as anyone else, other than it was God's will for me to be back, finish my education, get on into God's work.
And that timing worked out well for you, too, because you ended up meeting your wife, and she's sitting next to you right now.
Yes, very much so, and we thank the Lord that he was in that as well. Now, of course, she went to Biola on the West Coast here. I had started out at Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, which we used to always say, well, Biola is the outbreak of Moody from Chicago. But then I went on to Gordon College, which is Gordon Conwell, back in Boston still now today.
When you look back at your time in the service, is there any one thing that maybe you're most thankful for or most proud of or you think was most significant that you think when people think about World War II today, they ought to understand and remember?
Well, I guess one of the first things I think was America. After all, how proud am I of being an American, for to lay my life on the line, and God was in that. And we have a lot of liberties in America that I don't think the average person realizes, and the liberties are here all because our God, through the Lord Jesus Christ, made it possible for us to serve him and to carry on his work.
And I get the sense that, and obviously that is a huge part of your life, and I get the sense that serving your country was kind of a similar undertaking for you, that you felt serving your country was your way of serving God.
It was. It was. I was not in there just only to fly, well, what do I say, for America, but it was fight for God and for our liberties to be continued on as they always have.
Well, and that's why we're so thankful for the young men and women who are serving our country today, trying to do the same thing in what is now an all-volunteer force. Well, John, thank you so much, not only for serving our country, but for being here today to share some of those stories with us. I'm sure there are some stories that we left out, but that's why people can come and meet you and shake your hand and hear them from the horse's mouth, so to speak. And I didn't want to cap you at 95 years old for continuing your work, so go to 100 and beyond, all right?
Amen.
Amen to that. John Shearer has been our guest today. I will post some more information about him and his experiences on our website at kmjnow.com, maybe even a photo of him as well, so you can see what a good-looking young lieutenant he was and what a good-looking 93-year-old he is today. That is our program for today. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes right here on News Talk 580 KMJ.